This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This week on the Compass, we talk with Port Townsend's own delegates to the recent Paris climate talks, and then we attend a high school chemistry class where a common household cleaner is presented as the possible green fuel for the future. So now, let's go inside the Compass. Last June, Port Townsend teacher and county waste reduction specialist Laura Tucker was invited by the Will Steger Foundation to apply to be one of 10 teachers to attend the Paris Climate Talks with the group Climate Generation. After some weighing of the merits, she and her husband, Hank Walker, decided to go for it, and so it was that Port Townsend had its own delegation of sorts at the historic international conference at which the nations of the world came to an accord to try and steer the planet away from carbon-based calamity. I met with Tucker and Walker shortly after their return from Paris last week to get a first-hand report of their experience.
Up until this year, I wouldn't have even thought about going, just because it seems like everybody shows up and nothing ever happens. But I had heard some really compelling information prior to that. Things looked like they might have been shifting in a new direction. I heard the French Minister of the Environment say that this is the conference where we decide who lives and who dies. And she said that last March. And that kind of got my attention, too, that maybe this time people could get serious. So I applied, and part of the application was doing a daily blog with students that you work with. And since I work with kids all over the county, I thought, you know, that a blog of just my words would not be that interesting, at least to me anyway. So I decided that we would find really interesting young climate scientists and activists at the conference and link them up with students here in Port Townsend via Google Hangout, and that would be the really interesting part. And I was accepted, and shortly thereafter, France cut the delegate list by 80%. And they were only going to allow two of the 10 teachers into the what they call the blue zone, where the discussions were going on. And since we're not from Minneapolis, so we would not have had those credentials because the foundation's based in Minneapolis. So we just decided that we would do this on our own because there's a giant conference that's part of the whole thing, and that I'm affiliated with a lot of different climate education groups. And Hank does a lot of work on non-motorized transportation, and we had some frequent flyer miles, and we just decided last June that we would just go.
So once you got there, where did you go? Who did you see?
There were a number of climate action zones around Paris, besides Les Bourget, where the blue and the green zones were, where the conference actually was. But most of the advocacy work was happening in the alternative areas, and we went to Centra Center, and we helped out with a number of projects. First, we were English translators. We had vests that said, "I speak English," and we directed people to the proper forum that they were looking for. And then we helped out. There was one called the Ribbon Tree Project out of New York City. A number of advocates designed, I'd say, a 25-foot tree built out of wood. They CAD designed it. They shipped it to France. It was laser cut and assembled in France, and it's going to be donated to a city. But they had a nationwide call to have people on ribbons write what they're grateful for and their reasons for hope. So it was a really positive message amidst, you know, a pretty difficult crisis that we're all living
in. I think feeling hopeful has been one of the really difficult things about the climate crisis. So what kind of reasons for hope did people put out there?
That we could actually get off oil. People know it's the end of oil. Even though public gatherings and protesting was made illegal in France beginning the 13th of November for a month. This was done before the attack. France has a history. They did it once before a G8 in Nice in the early 2000s. So they just kind of preempt the advocacy that's huge in Europe, the protests.
Well, I saw that people figured out ways to protest anyway. I saw the shoe protest.
Protest was quite eerie. They said, "We can't march." So they set up 10,000 pairs of shoes in one of their squares. And at the opposite end of that was a giant memorial to the victims of the terror attack. So you had, we're not going to walk, but here, our shoes are going to be here. And a couple of very famous people, Laura remembers, sent their shoes.
The Pope and Ban Ki-moon both sent shoes to be part of that. Yeah. When we first arrived, when we made our plane reservations, all we knew was there was a two-week conference. And what I was supposed to be part of was the second week with the Will Steger group. But we didn't know what was going to happen. And later on, a big march was scheduled on the 29th. So we were very excited to be part of that march. And then when it was canceled, we went to a sunrise ceremony at this Place de la République, and my French is terrible. But it's one of their main plazas, and it also has a big statue of their version of liberty there, too. And that's where the memorial was. But that's where the march was supposed to start. So that's why they had over 20 or 30,000 pairs of shoes. We have some pictures that we put on the blog of that. It was quite compelling, and people were still putting shoes there that morning. But what I thought was not only hopeful, but incredibly creative. Here's all these different groups, probably several hundred groups were represented there, maybe even over 1,000. And there wasn't one group coordinating anything. And they managed to kind of communicate with each other and decide all these workarounds with, if we can't march, then we're going to have a human chain. So they made a chain from the plaza along buildings for several miles, where they just lined up with their backs against a building, all these different groups. They still had their signs. They had statements. They had people on bicycles with chants on flags. And so as the bicycle went by you, that was the chant that you did. And so it was this very affirming kind of uplifting sort of thing. And we were also helping with the ribbon project that day. We were helping get people to create more ribbons that were lined up along in the human chain. So that was pretty uplifting, too. We also were hoping, we didn't know that there was going to be a march on the 12th of December. That, again, sort of organically came about during those 2 weeks. And that was the day we flew home. We were hoping to get bumped, but we didn't. But that was, there were hundreds.
Oh, so there was a march.
There was hundreds of thousands of people in France, in Paris specifically. They said 12:12:12 at noon. And so I know 350.org was part of organizing that. But they decided that they were going to make this red line of, okay, you guys have got this agreement, but now we're going to give you our line that you're not going to cross. And you're not going to warm this planet more than 2 degrees. And you're not going to keep pulling fossil fuels out of the ground. So people had red shirts. They had big, long swaths of wet red fabric. There were miles and miles of people and hundreds of thousands of folks that still showed up. And from our perspective, everywhere that we looked, it was very peaceful. There was a reasonable police and military presence, but we didn't see anyone jostled around or bothered or anything like that.
So there was no attempt to shut it down?
No, not that we, well, on the 12th, we heard that there wasn't any. No, it looked like a pretty wonderful kind of city full of.
But even when you were like there earlier and you were standing with your backs to the wall and so on, I mean, that could still be interpreted as a form of demonstration, which had been forbidden.
Right. No. In fact, we thanked a number of police officers and a number of folks in the Army for just allowing people to do what they needed to do. I know there was some arrests here and there. Apparently the anarchists started taking some of the memorial apart. And then I heard that climate change folks there surrounded the memorial and protected it from any more destruction. So we didn't see that. There was a number of police vehicles and a number of folks there, but it was all quite, I think, there was a really elevated mood of something really amazing could happen here. And then at the end of the 2 weeks, the celebrations were huge because it's the first time the world's ever come together for an agreement like that. And it's not as far as we would like it to go, but it's certainly a start. And they, we had a...
Were you surprised that there was an accord reached?
I don't know if I would say so. I have been hopeful all along. And when we were involved with so many different climate groups and you just saw this surge that was heading towards Paris. And there was a wonderful group called Earth to Paris where people could send in hashtags and videos of to the world leaders. And what I really liked was their comment or the visual that they put together that said, we have the awareness, we have the technology, and we have the will for the first time to really make a difference. And I'm really, really honored that our governor, Inslee, collaborated with Jerry Brown of California and Shumlin of Vermont and the country of France with their environmental minister, and they put together a memorandum of understanding with those three states and one country that they are going to be reducing fossil fuels, the use of fossil fuels, and really promoting green energy. And California is the seventh largest economy in the world. And so you add Washington State and Vermont and the country of France to that, and you've got a real significant statement. And even though states can't make national policy, they can at least make policies within their own states and show others, you know, even large countries, how it could be done.
So you say you were in communication between Port Townsend, your students here, and students that you met at the conference. I mean, what kinds of exchanges went on there?
Well, it was actually two fifth grade classrooms, a seventh grade classroom and an eighth grade classroom from Blue Heron, and 10th graders in Lois Sherwood's science class at Port Townsend High School. And so we were incredibly lucky. We didn't know who we were going to find or how we were going to find them, but just by happenstance, the first day we found a wonderful 22-year-old Zoe from Australia who has a degree in environmental studies, and she's finishing up her degree in environmental law, has been a climate activist her whole life, tried to get solar panels on her school when she was younger, and she was incredibly inspirational to the kids. And so the second day, we met a young woman who is a physical oceanographer that studies the ocean around Antarctica. And she's also involved with transition towns in France. And we are one of those here in Port Townsend. And she had a picture of herself on a bicycle at the French station in Antarctica with a T-shirt on her back that said, "Change the system, not the climate." And so she was able to give the kids a lot of good technical information. And they had pre-thought of questions they wanted to ask whoever this person was that showed up each day. The third day, we met this amazing woman. And she's from the U.S., but she's incredibly passionate environmental engineer and started working initially with creating fuel out of algae grown on wastewater. And now she's working for a company in Berkeley that uses waste wood, chips of wood or nutshells or corn cobs, and gasifies them. So it creates energy, but then it also creates biochar that, when added to the soil, sequesters carbon and makes it a carbon negative source of energy. And then the fourth day, we stopped at the Sierra Club youth booth in the green zone, and that's where we met Esau, who is a Upiak Eskimo on this little spit of land in the Arctic Circle, and explaining to these fifth graders that his village has been under the influence of climate change for 30 years, long before people were talking about it that much, and how the ice flows have changed and they can't hunt the way they used to, and the berries aren't coming when they're supposed to. And so it's really affected their ability to hunt and gather, and that they've lost 3,000 feet of land in the last 30 years. They've had to move a number of homes. So he is the face of climate change. He's 18 and very well-spoken. Also wanted one of his buddies that he'd met from the Chinese youth delegation to come with him, and so he was part of the interview too. Duan from Beijing, who's 22 and a climate activist too. So it was very inspiring. Also, the students here gave us cards that they had made with a drawing on one side of something that they loved and valued, and on the other side a little bit about themselves and why they had hope. And we were able to give those cards to a number of people there that really inspired them. Kit Pinnell's class, her PI program from Chimicum, also sent cards, as well as ribbons that we got to hang on the tree, as well as individuals in Port Townsend that knew about it. Adults also sent us some ribbons and cards too. So it was really wonderful to be able to share with other people around the world that there's people in our community that are working hard too for positive effects on our planet.
So what have you brought home with you in terms of resolves for ongoing action?
Well, one of the biggest consensuses I came up with was the fact that people get it. It's our governments and, of course, major industries that, for one reason or another, refuse to accept the reality of climate change. And it seems to be a continuing upswell. This COP was just the beginning. This is a long-term battle, and we've got to get it right. And it's a question of time, you know, 20 years max, I would say. The solutions are out there. We have the intellect. We have the technology. We need the people to get into the streets, to write, to actually become involved, or they will be trodden under. I think it's that simple.
One of the, I think, strongest images for me of the what were we not thinking for years is it had this architect had these beautiful designs of Paris in 2050, and all of the buildings are covered with plants, and all of the roofs are covered with solar collectors, and there's holes in the buildings that have wind generators. So you see this beautiful green city, and it just occurred to me that our entire built environment, why are we not growing food plants as well as ornamental plants that sequester carbon and produce oxygen on every surface of our buildings? And why are we not collecting, you know, free energy from the sun on our roofs and having these wind generators? So you have this energy generation as well as you have carbon sequestration, you have food production, and it's beautiful. I think plus too, for us to make a difference on this planet, we can't say, no, all of you that work in the fossil fuel industry have to quit your jobs tomorrow because we're over with this. We have to have an option, you know, ways for people to still become employed, for industry to still exist. So instead of saying just no, we have to say not this, but this other thing. And for the survival of our species, we need to make some adjustment. Inslee had a great quote that Obama attributed to a governor, but it should have specifically mentioned Inslee. His quote that he had many years ago was that we're the first generation to feel the sting of climate change, and we're the last one to be able to do something about it. So those words ring very strongly in my ears.
With Laura Tucker and Hank Walker, fresh back from the Paris Climate Conference, this is Steve Evans reporting for KPTZ Community Radio News.
You're a chemistry class, and you're kind of halfway through, what, this is first term of chemistry for you? Okay. And so have you studied anything about hydrocarbons? Have you started to look at that at all? Does this look familiar at all? Okay, that does. Okay.
Clean Air Task Force Senior Advisor on Advanced Energy Systems, Dr. Steve Wittrig, was the guest speaker at a couple of Port Townsend High School chemistry classes last week, where he gave a lecture on the basic chemistry behind an idea for a non-polluting replacement for climate-changing fossil fuels, a potential solution to global warming so simple and seemingly obvious that even he seemed surprised that it had taken so long for it to come up. Because the alternative fuel is nothing exotic or rare. It is NH3, better known simply as ammonia, like the stuff in common household cleaners.
Okay, so this is actually a fairly new idea to the world. A lot of people, including me, I worked in the fuel industry for decades, hadn't really thought a lot about that. And there's a lot of ammonia that is manufactured, but it's used as fertilizer. It is actually the second most produced chemical in the world because of that.
Scribbling chemical equations on the projection stage of an overhead projector, Wittrig showed how the burning of ammonia as a fuel emits nitrogen as a side product rather than the greenhouse gas carbon dioxide that results from the burning of fossil fuels.
What happens if you burn ammonia? Okay, we can do this here. And, you know, there might be a lot of things that people would guess that would come out. I'll tell you that nitrogen comes out, and water. There's a few other small reactions that can take place, but this is the primary one.
Along with the chemistry, Dr. Wittrig's lecture included an explanation of the inner workings of turbines and electric power generators. Towards the end of the period, he opened the floor to questions.
Has there been a lot of research into how all this nitrogen would affect our atmosphere, or are we just assuming it's not going to make much change?
It would be very difficult to overwhelm the amount of nitrogen that's already in the air, because that's most of the air already. So do you know how much CO2 is in the air right now? It's 400 parts per million, okay? So that's a very small percentage. So, you know, that changes maybe one part per million per year. The amount of nitrogen that's in the air is, well, even say from 800 parts per million to 80% would be like 10,000 times as much. So we're not going to overwhelm the amount of nitrogen that's in the air, but that's a good question.
My question was, how long do you think it will be until we start seeing ammonia-driven cars and power plants in our lives?
It'll be in power plants before it's in cars. Because power plants sit on the ground and they've got engineers around them, and you don't have members of the public walking up and putting ammonia in them and that kind of thing. You you have control. So, in terms of power plants, my hope is within 1 or 2 years we'll have people that are actually prototyping these things. And that within 5 years that there's 50% year growth on this, and within 10 years that maybe 2% of the world's electricity comes from ammonia, and that would be a huge amount of energy. So that would be just my dream. But that hits right in the time you guys are going to be starting to go to college and then going out and working and making decisions on where you're going to get your power, or making decisions on the kinds of technologies you're going to work on and that kind of thing. This is going to be for your era. Whether it's ammonia or not is going to be new energy technologies. I think the bell didn't go off. Is that right? Or you guys got to get the heck out of here. So thanks very much.
Dr. Wittrig was invited to Port Townsend by the organizers of the monthly Energy Lunch program to present plans for a small ammonia-powered power plant prototype that afternoon at the Port Townsend Yacht Club. So, after the classroom cleared, I talked with him about that vision.
I understand that you came here for the Energy Lunch, actually, and you have this idea for a small neighborhood-based ammonia-powered power plant. Have you actually got a design for this in your back pocket?
I have a model that says, these are kind of existing pieces of equipment that, are relatively straightforward to apply to this kind of application. And this is how they might come together, and these are the right sizes, and this is about how much it would cost if you kludged together something like this.
What is that cost?
For the 1.5 megawatt diesel generator with CHP, you're talking something like $2 million.
Do you think this has advantages over like hydrogen fuel cells?
Yeah, because hydrogen's hard to store. Hydrogen is very high pressure and for very little energy.
Yeah. So in terms of the fuel itself, ammonia is kind of nasty to deal with.
Nasty to deal with? Yes, any fuel is.
It was in red.
When people say nasty, then you have to say, what different aspects are you talking about of nasty? Are you talking about that it smells bad? It's actually an advantage that it smells bad, because you can smell it if there's a small leak, okay? It's a lot less nasty than LPG, actually, because it's hard to explode ammonia. It's hard to ignite ammonia, actually. You have to, if you knock the valve off of an LPG tank, basically that'll, it goes out and it makes a cloud, and as soon as it finds a guy out smoking a cigarette or a truck running or something like that, you've got an explosive mixture that, can form a very big explosion. That's hard to do with ammonia. It's hard to ignite ammonia. It's got a small window for explosive mixture, and it's lighter than air. So, and if you look at hydrogen, if you get a leak from hydrogen, it does something called auto ignition. That means that just in the pressure let down, it gives enough heat that it gives you a very high temperature invisible flame. Actually, it basically can cut you in half if you walk through it.
There's only an advantage to using ammonia, of course, if that ammonia is generated through green means. So it's like green ammonia. And as I understand it, to take advantage of sort of the downtime at Bonneville or at my rooftop array or wind turbines when, you know, like they're turning at night and there's not the demand for the power.
There are ways to, you know, and really some of the early ways to make the hydrogen to run the hydrogen and nitrogen, you know, chemical reaction to make ammonia were electrolysis of water. So, you know, with electricity from solar or wind or hydropower and, you know, excess nuclear or whatever, you basically, you know, it's a high school chemistry demonstration that you can run electrolysis and, you know, oxygen comes off here and hydrogen comes off here and you can isolate the nitrogen from the air relatively inexpensively and certainly straightforwardly. And people are doing it. This is how you would make ammonia from green electricity, okay? Now, it is, as you might imagine, not as cheap as, you know, making it in giant plants from, you know, in the way that we industrially make it now. Now, there are ways to make green ammonia really from methane as well, if you do the sequestration, okay? You make the hydrogen from the natural gas. Basically, as part of the process, you have to separate out the CO2, and it's pure CO2, okay? So you don't have to do carbon capture, essentially, because it's part of the process. So that's ready for sequestration, and that would be low-cost sequestration.
Like, how do you sequester that?
You basically put it into reservoirs, you know, saline aquifers or, you know, emptied out gas reservoirs. So
you're pumping it underground.
You're pumping it underground, yeah, right. And, you know, compression and, you know, injection of gases into oil and gas reservoirs is something that's, you know, been done for 100 years.
But the only ammonia available now is brown ammonia.
Yeah, sure.
And that as the green of ammonia becomes available, it's much more expensive. I mean, there's obviously a real
there's
an incentive then to use the brown ammonia. And actually,
Absolutely.
Brown ammonia is a worse fuel than natural gas,
it's
right?
Because more CO2 intensive than natural gas.
Right.
No question. Yes. Right. That. So look at the analogy. Look at the hydrogen economy. Everybody wanted to develop the hydrogen economy and fuel cells and things like that. Was that green hydrogen? No. 80% of that came from hydrocarbons, basically, which, you know, is exactly the same situation. If you look at, you know, the initial implementations of new technologies, if you say before we do the prototypes or start developing the, you know, the back end or the front end or whatever, we have to have something that's, you know, green all the way through to do that, then you delay, of course, any implementation of a lot of things. You know, look at electric cars. I mean, you know, people say, you know, depending on where you run your electric car around the world, if it's, you know, if it's running off of 50% coal-fired power or whatever, it's, you know, worse than your dad's Buick and, you know, that kind of thing. So there will always be, you know, kind of within the supply chain of any kind of new thing you come up with, you're going to have to get into it in that way. And, you know, you have to just be straightforward about that and say, this provides the path for when green ammonia becomes available to use the CO2-free fuels. This provides probably the cheapest way and the cheapest option for responding to a large carbon tax, for instance. In the vision of we want to have a world that is powered on even, let's say, 25% of the carbon we're using right now, much less zero carbon, that is going to be more expensive always than pumping hydrocarbons out of the ground and using that energy.
With Dr. Steve Wittrig, who is the Senior Advisor on Advanced Energy Systems for the Clean Air Task Force, this is Steve Evans reporting for KPTZ Community Radio News. This week's KPTZ Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans. The Compass airs Mondays and Saturdays at noon, Tuesdays at 5 p.m., and Wednesdays at 10 a.m., exclusively here on KPTZ, the home of eclectic, authentic community radio. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.